In this episode of Startups for the Rest of Us, Mike and I talk about Hittail, Audichark, and the goings-on of the last 5 weeks. This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 158. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or you're just thinking about it. I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. Mike, what's the word this week? I haven't talked to you for almost a month.
I replaced you on the podcast for a little while.
I could tell. I was a little concerned. Dave did such a good job. I was thinking, uh-oh, I might be out of a job. I might need to go solo, start my own podcast. Because, yeah, I liked the episodes you guys cranked out.
But I hope the listeners did too. You know, hope they enjoyed a little break from you.
Yeah. So obviously, the reason I was gone was for MicroConf Europe. You and I were out of town for a week, and then I stuck around for another 3 weeks with my family. I wanted to work about a half hour a day was my plan, like 7 days a week. Get up, check email, do some stuff, just to make sure I kept up with it. I wound up working about an hour every 3 days. And with the internet connectivity the way it was, which was mediocre, it was a very rejuvenating month, and I got a lot of thinking done. I did come back. We launched Drip to about 1,500 people while I was in Italy in October. And that was kind of cool to see that go on. I would get the emails, and then just I wanted to work through the launch list before I got back. And, you know, that was kind of the only way to do it. I don't want to be launching in November and December, right? Because we know everything calms down during that time. So how about you? Any new updates?
Well, last night, as a matter of fact, I finally got the Linux support fully functional in the new UI. I've been kind
of talking about Audichark.
Since we cut over to the new UI, there was a lot of things just little stuff here and there. It's like, oh, I don't know if this works, or I don't know if that works. And so I was just kind of going through everything, making sure that everything still worked. And for the most part, I mean, my paying customer is still happy and has made more than one payment at this point. So
nice.
That's good.
I love that, my paying customer.
But I have had conversations with the other people who have signed on. And I think I mentioned on the last episode that we've got a concrete list of things that we're working towards and trying to get those things resolved and out the door. And so I'm working on certain things. My developer is working on other things. And we're kind of meeting in the middle because fortunately the things we're working on are separate from one another. And one of the things I was working on was making sure that the Linux support was working end to end. And I finally got that working again. It does work because I do have Linux policies because I've got the third guy who's working for me. He's building all the Linux stuff. I'm basically making sure that it works in the UI. And then the other developer I have is working on reporting.
Linux is a pretty key piece, right?
Yes.
In terms of the early access customers or the beta list, the mailing list you had, when you've asked people, there may even be more interest in Linux support than you have in Windows support. Is that right?
Yeah, it's leaps and bounds ahead of Windows, actually. There's a bunch of people who have both Windows and Linux, and they're basically waiting around and saying, well, you know, let me know when you've got Linux support in there, and then I'm willing to kind of take a look and move forward with it. But if it's just Windows, I don't necessarily care right now. And then there's a lot of people who just have Linux.
Yes, it sucks because you don't want to be writing a bunch of code right now, right? What you want to be doing is getting people in early access and marketing and ramping up. And basically, you want to get to 1.0 as soon as possible so that you can slow down. You're obviously always going to be building features, but it's like building Linux support is a big endeavor. And so are you at the point where it's done and tested, or is it kind of like, all right, now we have 2 or 3 weeks to figure out, you know, to work out the kinks basically?
It's a hard question to answer because there's several different sides of it. So there's, as I said, I've got one person who's working on just reporting. And one of the things that's coming up is that people want to be able to see, if I run a report now, I want to be able to compare my current results versus my previous results very, very easily. And they want to see where things have regressed. So there's something going in called a regression report. And that's got to be built, you know, like currently things are just being stored raw using a backend blob storage. So there's not a good way to compare things from one version or from one set of audit results to the next. So that's one piece that's being built in with the reports. And then another one is being able to compare things over date ranges as well. So like they basically want to see a priority on the, you know, the 400 to 600 plus things that are in there now that we're examining on their servers. And they say, I need you to prioritize these for me because that would be more valuable to me. Because right now we basically just say, here's the information, here's what's okay, here's what's not okay, but we don't prioritize it for it. There's this piece that needs to go in on the reports to be able to show them that prioritization. And then in the back-end policies, my other developer has to go in and basically assign the priorities to everything. So there's the two different things that are kind of moving at the same time. And then the third piece that I'm working on is basically making sure that the Linux stuff runs end-to-end, which it hasn't been until last night. So now that that's running, once some of the priority stuff goes in, which will have to be done on Linux as well, then the reporting side goes into it. And so it's just kind of like all three things are coming together all at the same time. And once those three things are in place, then it would provide, I think, the value that it really needs to. Because I'm going to have the same question marks from people who are using it on Windows as they are on Linux, because they're going to want those things to be prioritized. They're going to want to be able to see regression reports. And I actually had a in-depth conversation with one person who said, this information that you're providing me is awesome, but his problem was around the fact that he didn't want to have to go in every single day and try to remember what was different from one day to the next. What he really wanted, he's just like, I just want a daily email that says, have things gone off the rails? So, but it's called the everything's okay alarm, and it will continue to sound while everything is okay. So basically just a daily email that says, hey, nothing's changed today. You know, between yesterday and today, nothing's changed. You just haven't gotten any worse. Not better, but things have just not gotten any worse.
Yeah.
And that's, somebody told me specifically, they're like, that's awesome. That's exactly what I need. And if I had that, he's like, after seeing that for about 2 weeks or so, I'd probably turn it off, knowing that you would let me know if things got worse. And he's like, as soon as I decide to turn that off, that's when I would be willing to pay.
Nice. And this person you were talking to is an early access customer. Is that right?
Yes.
Or not a customer, but a user. You yet, but he's basically saying, that's what I need in order to pay you. Very good. One feature at a time, huh? It's like you implement one thing for one customer, and then they'll pay, and that'll get you this other group of customers. And maybe it's a handful. And then you just branch out slowly. And it's just kind of knocking these things off the list that allows you to get a bigger and bigger market. It's like right now you've solved the problem for one person, and just slowly over the course of weeks and months, you'll be able to expand that market. So what's your timeline like? Let's say like next week, do you think you will have enough done that you'll have another paying customer? I mean, what does it look like for you over the next month or two?
The reporting stuff should be going in this week. Now, whether the data is there on the policies to be able to do the prioritizations and things, I don't know that yet. I have to touch base with the guy who's working on that and just kind of verify that he's working in that direction. And there's some things that need to go into his policy builder to help him enable that, or to help enable that for him to make it easier. So I have another person who's working on that side of things who he's supposed to be doing that tomorrow. It might be done within the next day or two after that. So realistically, if I had to guess, I'd probably say it's going to be another 2 or 3 weeks before all of that stuff is completely ready, but it'll be done in bits and pieces between now and then. So like, I think that the reporting stuff will be done, you know, either tomorrow or the day after. The policy builder stuff hopefully will be done maybe tomorrow or the day after. And then once he's done with that, then the policies can be updated. But even then after that, the people who I hand this off to, they're still going to need time to get comfortable with it, take a look at the reports, and then make their decisions off of that. And that might take the first email. It might take 2-3 weeks of them getting the emails and reports to be able to say, okay, yeah, I'm comfortable with this.
Right. And that's the free trial period, right? You'll just be running it manually. But once they actually start using it, they don't pay you the first day. You give them time to try it out. And like I was saying, when I was doing the manual onboarding with Drip, I was giving people as long as they needed to feel confident that Drip was basically making them money, you know, that it was saving them time and making them money. And so some people had 6-week trials. It was just completely arbitrary, but I only had 15 people trialing, and I was manually emailing everybody individually. I was watching all of their accounts. I was watching the number of subscribers, the number of conversions that were coming in. And then at a certain point, it was obvious, you know, someone had like $400 or $500 in conversions come in 3.5 weeks. And so I emailed them and said, look, do you feel like this is worth it? And they said, yes. And so that's the nice part about doing manual onboarding, although it's time intensive, it allows you to get a feel for how long it takes people. But you're going to be able to look at, based on the complexity of their setup, based on their knowledge, based on how much time they have, you'll have an idea of like, huh, people can actually get value out of this in 2 weeks. And so your trial should be 2 weeks, or maybe it'll be 30 days. But whatever it is, you're, I mean, because right now you probably don't know how long your trial should be, right? You could take a guess, but you don't really know because you don't have enough experience.
Well, it's not even that I don't have the experience. The problem is that I'll onboard somebody and they'll say, and I'll ask them the question, would you pay for this? And they'll say, if it had this feature and this feature, then I would pay for it. And it's like, okay, well, then I have to go off and build that feature
right. And
make sure that it works. And it might make take two, 3, 4 weeks to do that. And then once I've done that, you're adding 2, 3, 4 weeks in there.
Yep.
It's hard to judge at that point. And I don't have the data. I don't have enough throughput through the pipeline of new customers that are being onboarded to be able to make those determinations. In 3 or 4 months, I think that'll be a completely different story, but I have no idea right now. I just can't answer that.
Right. You know, you're in the midst of what I've started calling the slow launch. And this is basically the fact that I had customer zero onboarded on a drip in April, and we are going public tomorrow. And it's now early November. So what happens in that 6 or 7 month span? Well, we were doing manual onboarding. We were building features per request, just like you said, where we would say, are you willing to pay for this? They'd say, no, I need XYZ feature. We would go build that. And slowly getting one paying customer at a time and then launching to 300. It was, you know, exhilarating, and it got, I don't know, 50 or 100 trials in the door. And then we saw how many converted, and you just build from there. I think we have a luxury because we don't have a venture-funded board at our back saying, you have to move faster, you have to hire faster, you have to grow faster. Now, it could also be detrimental if we're not super motivated to get things done. But frankly, if you have a launch list or you have customers who are interested in it, the best thing you can do is implement the features they need before you try to get them into a trial. Because otherwise, you dump them into this trial, you get them onboarded, and then poof, they're like, ah, there's just not enough value here. Right? And then you have to go build a bunch of stuff and come back to them. I actually think you maximize conversion rates by doing this slow launch over time and letting in groups of people, working with them manually, figuring out what they want, what they need, implementing it. Then you let in another 10%, 15% of your list, seeing what happens with them. For me, it's been a huge learning experience to learn more about the customers of Drip, the people who it works for and who it doesn't, the people who really understand it from day one, and the people who need more education.
The other thing is that, and I'm sure Drip is a little bit different than what I've got to deal with. One of the guys who had come to me and started talking to me about early access has 70 servers. Of course, that falls in kind of like the enterprise space for, you know, my product, you know, because it's at least $2,500 a month probably for just that one customer. So I went back to my developer and I'm like, can we even do this right now?
Right.
And he's like, no.
Yeah,
no.
Too much volume.
So just, you know, because things need to be re-architected in the background. So,
sure.
You know, as part of this reporting process that he's working on, that stuff is going to be taken care of as well, which is kind of nice to see. But a lot of questions and stuff you have to answer about scaling up.
Sure. Yeah, we actually are seeing scaling issues as well. But see, we're real-time analytics. You know, we have every time someone visits your website, we get a ping back and we insert a record in the database because we have to be able to track referrers of all the new visitors. We have to track every time the pop-up widget opens to collect an email. And we offer all that data up in the app. And so we have already upgraded kind of the database hosting twice, and we're in the process of doing it a third time to fix some reports that are starting to get slow for people. The real-time stuff, which is, you know, in massive data collection like you're doing, and like actually Hittail and Drip both do it, it's kind of a pain. But I also think it's a nice barrier to entry. Because a lot of folks, it's not just some simple CRUD SaaS app that someone can build and host on a shared server. It really takes some expertise to keep the thing running.
Yeah, I know what you're talking about there. I've already gotten some complaints about some of the reports in there as well. It's just, oh, these reports are slow. And I'm like, yeah, I know. But, you know, I'm getting a couple of megs worth of data from just one audit. Mm-hmm. And it's like, okay, well, you know, you throw 5-10 machines in there and it's mm-hmm. it becomes a lot of data very, very quickly.
Right. So I guess to wrap up kind of a Drip update, like I said, we launched to about, it was somewhere between 1,200 and 1,500 more people during October. And then we are launching to the final, basically the last third of the list today. And then by the time this podcast airs, Drip will be live. Like you'll be able to go to getdrip.com and basically, you know, see the tour and sign up for a plan just like anyone else, sign up for a free trial. So that feels good. You know, it feels good to finally hit that point, although it is a bit anticlimactic because, I mean, we already have paying customers, revenue. Last month was recurring revenue was up $1,000 over the previous month, and it's on pace to do that again this month. And so we're already launched in my mind. You know, the public launch is more of a formality at this point. The amount of recurring revenue that we've had while we were in early access, it'll be several months until we basically duplicate that, until we get that much revenue doubled. So about 2 weeks ago, we launched a group of about 600 on the list. And it was, before that, we had basically nothing. All we had was a sign-up page, a sign-up and a login page, and then you could get in and the app was fully done, but there was no marketing website. And about 2 weeks ago, we got just a shell marketing website up, and it was like an about page, privacy policy, terms of service, FAQ, just a couple things. And some of it was lorem ipsum, and some of it wasn't finished. You know, I mean, it was just kind of up there, and I didn't link to any of it. I really just linked to a pricing page where they could sign up, but the pricing page did have footer links to some of those pages. I specifically called that out in the emails and said, look, this stuff isn't done, but, you know, you can poke around if you want. Right away, we started getting emails that our about page was lorem ipsum. And some guy tweeted me saying, or he said, is this serious? I'm going to cancel my trial because your about page isn't done. And we probably got 4 or 5 emails within a week of people
really?
Who were flipping out about the about page. It was crazy, yeah. It was all lorem ipsum text. It was our images, the actual images. But that's at getdrip.com/about if you want to check it out. I was totally surprised. And the fact that it wasn't just one person really was indicative to me that people wanted to find out who was behind it or something. There was some desire to see this about page and for it not to just be boilerplate text.
Yeah, that's kind of crazy. I don't even know what to make of that.
It makes sense now that it happened, but I never would have expected it. I mean, if the privacy policy in terms of service were lorem ipsum, they weren't. But if they were, I bet no one would have cared.
Well, speaking of adding new content to the website, I implemented that content strategy that Brecht Palumbo from the Bootstrapped with Kids podcast had talked about on there, and Patrick McKenzie had also talked to me about. Over, I think it was last week, I put more than 400 pages of content live on the website that's all generated from the policies that we're executing on people's machines.
Very nice. Have you seen any results from it yet?
Yeah, Google hasn't indexed it yet, so still kind of waiting for that to happen. And then once it does, it'll be interesting to see what sort of traffic it generates. I don't necessarily have very high expectations for it. They're very, very specific things that if people were searching for those, then great. And maybe they would sign up. I just don't know. I don't have a good sense of whether or not those people would come to the site and say, oh, well, I'm not going to have to do these things on my servers anymore, because they may just be doing them as one-off things and, you know, they just don't need to do them again. I want to see how it goes. I want to see what sort of traffic comes in, but I have to wait for Google to index it because they just haven't done it yet.
Sure. You know, you can certainly keep an eye on it. I mean, you're going to want a call to action at the bottom of every one. I would also, you know, if you don't already have the Drip widget installed, I think that'll be a nice way to connect with people, is to collect their email address. Because the idea of someone stumbling on it and signing right up for a trial is probably not going to happen that often. But if they are at least interested in that topic and you can stay in touch with them over time and use your nice autoresponder sequence you've already created in Drip, that's certainly a good way to, you know, nurture those leads and stay in touch with them. I think that'll be a better converting source than trying to get them to sign up for a trial on the spot.
Yeah, Drip is already installed there and it's already available. So when you go to those different policies and the different items that are on there, they do show up right away. The Drip course is down there, so they could sign up for it. But yeah, I totally agree with that. I don't see any reason why that wouldn't at least help.
Sure. Very cool. I did some more investigation and kind of have been watching HitTail over the past month since we last discussed it. Our last update, we talked about how Google was going to 100% not provided. And I think they're, I don't know, in the 80s or 90% at this point. And what I noticed is that Google, at least in the U.S., is about 67% of U.S. search traffic. And what's funny is that HitTail is still doing quite well on the other 33%. Like, it's using, you know, AOL and Bing and Yahoo and kind of the other market. And so there have been some customers who their keyword suggestions through HitTail have decreased substantially, and that's a bummer, obviously. You know, if they had 95% Google traffic, there's not much to be done there. But at the same time, it hasn't been as much of a, maybe an Armageddon as I had imagined. There still is room for for there to be keyword suggestions. I mean, if you think about it, no one is going to have this data, and every single keyword you have now is worth so much more than it was a month ago when it was abundant. Dave Collins talked about that in MicroConf Europe, just about how valuable, how hard keyword data is going to be to come by. And so it's that funny thing of like a tool like Hittail or Longtail Pro or Market Samurai, it may take a hit with the not provided stuff. It can still be as or more valuable than, you know, any other resource you have, because you don't even have that data in your Google Analytics anymore. That's not the end of the world. I thought, you know, Hittail wasn't going to make it. And at this point, it doesn't seem like that. Like, it seems like it's going to stick around.
So here's a question for you. You said that when you were onboarding people, you were kind of watching to see what they were doing. Did you have dashboards built into your application to monitor, I guess, user activity and overall user health? Or did you like put that onto another application that you subscribe to?
Are you saying like how often they logged in or something?
Yeah, things like that. So like, did they perform a certain action, or when's the last time they logged in? Have they gotten, you know, have they sent out a campaign, that kind of stuff?
Right, right. So we talked about using a service like intercom.io or customer.io or one of those retention services that allows you to have insight into what folks are doing. The further we looked into it, the more I realized that we wanted to just look at our database. Like, it was literally some select queries to figure out what people are doing. Basically, we have a last login date. We also have a number of logins, you know, like a quantity of logins for every person. And so I can see if they're active, and I can see when they last logged in. And then just by doing a select count from campaigns, you can see if they've activated a campaign. We did write some code to go like hit their URL and figure out if they'd installed our JavaScript. We look in the database to see if they've created a goal. Like, there's three steps someone needs to complete to basically get the full onboarded part of Drip. We can get that all from our own database. We don't need any type of real instrumentation to do that. And I think if we did need instrumentation, I would probably have just built it myself. Again, the further we got in, the more I realized, wow, I'm going to have to sync my data and all my customer stuff with an external system. And every time we add, edit, delete something, we need to call out and do that. That just seemed like more trouble than it was worth when we can kind of just run an ad hoc query and get that info out. And I do have a dashboard. I do have an admin area where it shows me a bunch of check marks, you know, of who's done what, who hasn't done what. And those people, of course, get different emails. We have this whole custom email course during their trial that sends them different things at different times based on what they have and haven't done. And it tries to help them get onboarded. And it doesn't just push it off onto them either. It doesn't say, oh, go do this. It actually says, please reply to this and we'll be in touch. Please reply to this. We'll do it for you. We'll walk you through it. That kind of stuff. Are you, I assume you're asking because you're at the point with Autotruck that you're looking at options.
Yeah, I mean, I've looked at, you know, the ones that you had mentioned. I came across Woopra and Totango. It's funny because they all solve a slightly different problem, and none of them really solves the problem that I was actually looking to solve. So, you know, I could kind of mash things together, but in some ways I'm kind of leaning towards building my own dashboard like, you know, you were talking about. And it's just like, I don't want to have to add that to like the engineering plate. You know what I mean?
Yeah. No, I hear that. It is when it's building new features or building basically that's instrumentation, it makes it tough. I think it took us less than 4 hours to do it because it was, I mean, I could hack that together with literally some SQL queries that just, you know, display on a white background in the dashboard. So it's not like a ton of, unless you have a ton of stuff you need to instrument, it's not that hard to get this done. Now,
yeah.
Sending the emails is, that's not trivial. Actually, to be honest, sending the emails isn't. It's a big case statement, right? If they're on this day and they've done this, then send this email. The hard part and the part that took longer than the development was writing all the emails.
Yeah, and I've already started working on the emails themselves. It's just a kind of a matter of deciding how those things are going to get sent out and how they're going to get triggered.
Yep.
So.
Yeah, and that was where, here's what I did. I put together a spreadsheet and I looked at all the cases and all the days of what people could do on what point and where we wanted them to be. And I mapped out how many emails needed to be sent and I gave them all names. And then I went off and I wrote all of them. And it probably, that process of mapping it out and writing them probably took me 12 hours. It was tremendously time intensive. And then once I had that mapped out, I showed it to the developer, to Derek, and he was basically like, yeah, I can get these to send out based on these cases that you said in like 2 hours, because it's literally select this, check if they've done that. If they haven't, send him this variation of it. It didn't take him very long. So the mechanism of sending the email, again, is not, I don't think it's that intense. And I think trying to do it internally, I don't know. That's just, it seemed to work for us.
And I've looked at that as well. It's, I don't think that sending the emails would be that difficult. I've got about a third of them written. I think there was a list of about 15 or 20 that I wrote down, different situations where I was like, oh, I want an email to be sent out if this happens. Or if, you know, for example, when they first get their first set of audit results, I want to send them an email and say, hey, just let you know you got your first audit results, and, you know, explain them a little bit and walk them through what the next step in the process is. And if they have any questions, to get in touch with me. You know, there's obviously the other side of it, which is the dashboard information. It's like, has this been sent to them? You know, has this situation occurred for such and such customer? And then being able to take those events and just kind of throw them into a database or something like that and be able to report on them. But as you said, I mean, I could throw those into my own database and then just report on them. It's just a matter of the engineering time and effort needed to build those reports. And I'm kind of leaning towards taking my other developer and putting him on that stuff. I haven't made a solid decision yet.
Yeah, that makes sense. I think what I found with the kind of the back-end admin stuff, the reporting like you're talking about, is that figuring out what I want and then kind of speccing it out is as much time as to just actually write it. Since our app is in Rails and I don't code proficiently in Rails, it does make sense for me to give it a lot of thought and spec it out and everything. But if it was in a language I knew, I would probably, at least with Drip, I would probably just sit down and hack it out myself. That's what I did with Hittail. When I needed any type of reporting, I would just, you know, write the SQL and execute it myself. The Numa Group, which is my little company that has Drip and Hittail and all the other stuff, I was up to 5 people. Did I tell you that? 5, not employees, because, you know, it's that W-2 versus 1099. What does it really matter? But it was, in essence, it was 5 almost full-time people, including myself. And I feel like I should be kicked out of the Micropreneur Club for that.
I think the micropreneur route is more about bootstrapping it yourself than it is about the actual size.
Yeah, I think it's bootstrapping. I think it's also freedom. Like I had, again, 5 people including myself. So it was 4 folks. But I still didn't need to be anywhere at any given time. You know, unless someone ran into an issue, I didn't need to be online 9 to 5 on Skype or something like that. I didn't need to go into an office and see folks. So the freedom aspect that I enjoy was still in place. And to be fair, I mean, one guy is Derek, and he and I have now worked together for about a year and a half, I guess. I enjoy hanging out with him. We hang out outside of work, right? We're friends. One of them is my support guy. It's Andy. He does support for the Academy and for Hittail and now for Drip. So he's kind of autonomous. I mean, unless he has a question, he's just rolling. He's in another country altogether, and so he's just rolling on stuff. And then I had the Growth Hacker intern, who I had talked about hiring a few months ago. And he's only here for 90 days. He's a 3-month internship, so he's leaving at the end of November. And then the other guy was a developer, a Rails developer we hired through Odesk, and he was with us for about maybe 6 or 8 weeks, and he got a ton of stuff done. He actually got us caught up and really got Drip to 1.0. Like between he and Derek, he kind of gave us just enough of a boost to get, we have a server-side API and a JavaScript API and a bunch of reports I needed, just some little things that I felt like weren't getting done quick enough. And I was planning to keep him around, but he was good. He just wasn't fantastic. Like he didn't quite fit perfectly with the team. And so once he had completed his stuff, he was just a little too much work to spec things out. And, you know, Derek had to spend a little more time going through his code than I would have liked. So we did decide to let him go. So now we're down. It's down to just me and Derek and Andy again, along with contractors and, you know, contractors who just kind of work on an ad hoc basis. And it feels good. It feels good to slim down for the holidays, I'll say, needing to be online less and handle the fires that come up less. It's good.
Yeah, see, part of my aversion to kicking you out of the Micropreneur Club with 5 people is because I'm currently at 5 as well.
Nice. Yeah, ha, it all comes out. But yeah, no, it is funny. It's funny how you get there slowly and it doesn't feel weird. And you know everybody and you hire them slowly. And to say you're at 5 people sounds big. I mean, 2 years ago, I would have said, holy Toledo, I don't want to be working with 5 people, you know? But I know now a lot of Black micropreneurs that are, you know, MicroConf attendees or bootstrappers from the academy or just folks we know who were solopreneurs for a while. And just over time, as you hire people and they're really good, it doesn't make any sense not to bring them on full time, especially if they're good and they can be autonomous and you can just kind of roll with it and you get way more done and they're really valuable to you. Like the thought of not hiring someone simply for a principal reason, you know, because you want to be that true solopreneur, it just stopped making sense to me maybe a year or two ago.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, I realized a while back that, you know, the whole single founder moniker is more of a, a rallying cry against angel and VC funding than anything else. It wasn't necessarily that you can do everything yourself. It's just that you can certainly start a business yourself and, you know, do a lot of things. But in order to make something that extends beyond you, it's very difficult to do it alone. But that doesn't mean that you can't be the person in charge of everything and kind of managing all the pieces. And that's kind of what I've backed off of at the moment. It's just like I'm managing all these individual pieces and kind of putting them together towards this greater goal, and everybody's managing their own work and I'm just managing the interactions between them at this point. But it's no longer just me.
Right. I always took your single founder moniker to be that you didn't want co-founders, not that you wouldn't hire people, but that it's you didn't, you know, you wanted to kind of do the initial founder part yourself.
Yeah, it is. I've had people get confused, though. So
that makes sense. Yeah, you know, this is actually a good time to bring up a question I think I've received. I know I'm wondering, you know, you may have as well. It's interesting that you and I are attacking larger product ideas, right? And so someone listening to this might think back to our very first episode where we talk about attacking these super tiny niches, making $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 per app, you know, and just cutting your teeth at it and getting some successes under your belt and then kind of scaling up or even just compiling three or four of those smaller earning apps and being able to quit your job. And I'm kind of moving away from that, you would say, right? I mean, now that I have a couple employees, now that I don't really have any small apps, I've started divesting myself of my really small apps because they at this point, they're more trouble than they're worth, because 1 hour spent building Drip is worth 10 times what was spent building, you know, some old B2C app that I had lying around. And so it's important to clarify that that old approach still works. I still see people doing it. I still see people having a lot of success in those niche markets, making a couple grand a month and building their skill set and doing the stair-step approach that we talk about. You don't need to go big. Don't go, I mean, if you're a first-time founder, don't go build an app like Drip. Drip is in an incredibly competitive market. There's so many email startups right now. They're venture-funded. There's all types of stuff going into them. You know, there's money coming in. The reason I'm attacking it is very specifically because I have the money. I have the experience. I have, 10, 15 successful apps under my belt. I've been solo now, full-time, not consulting for four years before I brought anyone on full-time. So all of that works, and you can be totally happy and have a lot of freedom under that model. The fact that you and I have now decided to tackle larger projects that are more, they just take a lot longer to get off the ground. They're more difficult, but they already, you know, they have a larger market space. It's not something I would advise for a first timer, but it is the next logical step for myself. I know, you know, and wanting to be challenged and learn and grow. Me doing another app that makes $5,000 a month or $10,000 a month, it just isn't. It isn't that interesting anymore because I've done it enough that you know you have to constantly carve yourself out those new challenges. I don't know. Have you thought about this at all? Have you been asked that?
A little bit here and there. I've heard where, you know, you and I are clearly not going after those types of things. And it's not that we're no longer going after those smaller markets because it doesn't work. It's just that our level of experience with those things and the types of things that we're interested in doing have kind of grown beyond that. And it's not to say that there's anything wrong with them or that there's anything wrong with that approach, because I agree. I totally think that it still works, especially when you get into things like you're building and I'm building, where it takes a lot of effort and expertise to be able to do those things. And if you don't have the experience building a team and putting out good products and building a business, it's a lot harder to build it from the ground up when you have no experience. I ran into a guy probably less than a month ago who wanted to build a two-sided marketplace for an application. And he'd never built an app before. His partners had never done it. And he really didn't necessarily know what he was doing. And he was going against, you know, venture-funded companies, and he wanted to bootstrap it. And I was just like, no, this is a bad idea 10 times over. You know, several other people talked to him and basically told him the same thing. And, you know, fortunately, he took it the right way. And it wasn't like, oh, you guys are just bashing me. It's like, you know, maybe I've miscalculated this, and maybe I really should take a step back and think about this, because they're going to pummel me and I'm going to waste 2 or 3, 4 years of my life doing something that is ultimately not going to be successful because they've got the money and they've got the backing, and I just can't compete in that particular market because I don't have the experience. If you have a question or comment for us, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690 or email it to us at questions@startupsarrestus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. You can subscribe to us on iTunes by searching for Startups or by RSS at startupsarrestus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of each episode. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.